I'm pleased to introduce Professor Roger von Swanenberg, who will be anchoring the next little while for us and speaking to us. He's, as Ibrahim mentioned earlier, he's the publisher of Pluto Press, was the founder of Zed Books, which, by the way, many of us here have helped pay your retirement plan by buying thousands of copies of the Development Dictionary, among other things. We thank you for that. What a great work. So, welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. I applaud your concentration for the third speaker over a long time, and I will try and keep your attention as best I can. And I'm also very grateful to be invited into what I take is the heartland of Christian teaching in Canada, and that is an honor indeed. Thank you. Now, what I propose to do is to provide a counter-narrative to those that you see in the press and very often what you're taught if you're a student in the in your regular classes. And what you've heard so far are two fine speakers from the Islamic world, and of course I cannot even begin to deal with the subjects that they have at their fingertips. So my approach will be really quite different. I want to start with the man in the cave. The man in the cave who started or declared war on the USA from Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden. The man who is supposed to be responsible for the attack on the Twin Towers. Now, I suspect that everybody here, it's an iconic period of your life. You will remember where you were when this event happened. And it's rather like, for those who are older of my generation, will remember where they were when Kennedy was assassinated. You will remember that for the rest of your lives. So it's a very important moment, not just for Americans, it's an important moment for the world. And this story, in many respects, is symbolic of the issues of political Islam. And at the same time, it's symbolic of the issues of empire. Before I get on to those, to try and draw out those strands of Islam, political Islam and empire, I want to just go through very briefly the context in which this happened. I published a particular interesting and important book by John Cooley called Unholy Wars. And in November 2003, Pluto Press had two books on Afghanistan. And there were two or three other books in the English-speaking world on Afghanistan. And that represents to you what the world thought of Afghanistan at that time. It was very low on the consciousness of people's minds. John Cooley had a particularly interesting story to tell. But before I tell you about that, let me just briefly tell you what happened to the other book. We sold a lot of books. We suddenly had a spike in our sales. It was amazing. The attack on the Twin Towers was good for Pluto Press. But nonetheless, the second book was attacked for libel by a Saudi Arabian some months later, and we were forced to take it off the market, and pay the Saudi a large sum of money. So today, that book does not exist. But John Cooley's book, Unholy Wars, has really stayed its time. His story was that the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan to support a communist government at the time. And what followed was bizarre. But Cooley's story is now accepted as fact. The USA funded financially the weapons and the money for a holy war to be fought against the Soviets. They used the Pakistan Secret Service to provide the logistics and to mobilize the Mujahideen from across the Islamic world to come to Afghanistan to fight this war. And as we know, that was a success from the US's point of view. So what we see is the Mujahideen and the USA at one with each other. They had a common enemy. Of course, their reasons for having a common enemy were quite different. And this bizarre set of events is now accepted as truth, that it actually happened. Of course, it happened below the sight line of the general public. But it illustrates how empire can work. And one of the consequences of this was that Pakistan, who did the arming of the Mujahideen, also armed its people in Kashmir. And the Kashmiri struggle, of course, was not quite different, but very different, and it was against the Indians in Kashmir. And as I say, the Americans were cock-a-hoo. They had defeated the Russians, the Soviets, and in fact, this was the beginning of the collapse of the Soviet Union as we then knew it. And Bin Laden had been sent out by Saudi Arabia as a senior operative in this war against the Soviets. And what happened, of course, was he turned tail and he then turned his ire on the on the West. Now let me just describe what I mean by the West, because the title of the future political Islam in the West, and as we heard from our first speaker, the West can mean many things. The West, to me, is very straightforward. It's the great powers of our time. It reflects the empire which is the dominant forces, which I shall explain in a few minutes. So, John Cooley exposed exposed an underground element of how the empire actually worked. And then what happened next? Well, of course, they couldn't demobilize the Mujahideen. And they all went home with the American tactics of guerrilla warfare in their back pocket. And we were now prepared for the next phase, which we're now all in. In other words, America had created the conditions for Islamic violence and resistance across the world. And that is the significance of John Cooley's work. He showed us how that was actually happening. Now, I want to provide for you a context. I mean, if you just hear me talk about this, it seems a bizarre, extraordinary. How can you explain America doing this? And you need to see and understand the history of empires. And I want just to explain for you for a moment how empires work and what they're about. My country, Britain, used to be the dominant empire. We became the dominant empire in 1815, after the end of the Napoleonic period, and we remained the dominant empire until 1915. And what that meant was that we determined the major economic forces in the world. We provided the world currency in which to trade, and that meant that the pound sterling was the not only the dominant currency, it was the currency that everybody accepted as having value when they were trading across borders. And if you've ever traded across borders, you will know that you need to to know value when you make an offer of a price. Now, what we wanted as the British, we wanted open markets. We wanted to be able to enter other people's countries and invest our capital and return the interest back to our home countries. We wanted to have access to the raw materials, the resources of other people's countries. And if we could do it by agreement, we did it by agreement. And if we couldn't do it by agreement, we did it by force. And of course, at that time, in the 19th century, there were many countries which weren't countries at all. The whole of Africa and large parts of the Middle East were not nation states. So one way or another, we created nation states. We invaded. We used whatever force was necessary. And we created new nation states. In Africa, the date is 1884, we sat down with our rulers in London and we drew lines on the map to create those nation states. And you will still see those straight lines today. And if anybody objected to what we were doing, we would use whatever force was necessary to put people down. What we wanted to do was to control and monopolize resources. And we went into the 1418 war. One of the major motives of that war, despite what you might read, was to destroy the Ottoman Empire and to take the resources of the area which we knew, where we knew there was oil, and have it for ourselves. And the period from about 1900 to 1922 is one of the bloodiest periods of anywhere in the world that you can imagine. And I'm not going to go into any of the details, but if you wish to find out, it is an extraordinarily interesting period. There's a number of novels which you can read. De Bernier has a fantastic novel about a village in Turkey. But of course, the history books will tell you the same period. And people were killed in their millions and were scattered all four corners of the earth. And in the end, of course, the British and the French divided up the territory for themselves. And that is one of the ways that empire works. Now, the other aspect of empire that I want to move to is to understand that the 1418 war had also exhausted the resources of Great Britain. And by 1918, she was, in effect, no more the major power of the world. And in fact, but not in, in principle, but not in fact, America, the USA, had taken her place. But the USA wasn't ready to take the role of the world dominant power at that time. And it needed another great war, the 39-45 war, to create the conditions for the USA to take over this role. And if you examine it quite carefully, you will see that in the 1930s, the American think tanks in Washington were already thinking about what they needed to do to create a world currency, which would be the dollar, supported by supported by gold. And this was all put into effect in 1944 at the Bretton Woods Agreement, where Britain was humiliated and told that her ideas were of no value, and America asserted her right to world dominance. Now, I'm telling you this because if you do not have a concept of empire in your heads and how that empire works, you really cannot begin to explain the events that I started off with in Afghanistan. You cannot begin to explain contemporary events without understanding the history of how these empires actually operate. Now, one of the elements that happened in 1945 was that the Soviets and the Americans looked as if they were going head to head. And America then made its major enemy anything to do with socialism and communism. And there is a huge debate among socialists of what was the Soviet Union. Was it actually a socialist country? And I don't want to get into that. But there is a big debate about it, and everybody says communism didn't work. Well, there's an argument about that too, that a weak country like the Soviet Union, which had been entirely a rural country 20 years earlier, when it was confronted by a huge arms race, which then took place, that they really were unable to compete with the Americans. And to many of us, it was inevitable that the Soviet Union at some point would collapse, as well it did. So, what we have is the new imperial dominant country, the USA, using its muscle in every way that it could, as the British had used it before, but using it through different mechanisms. They needed, as the British did, open markets. They wanted access to resources. And they did this through the use of the major international banks, the IMF, the World Bank, and all the other international institutions that were associated with the World Bank and the IMF. And what they did was very straightforward. Any country which had got itself into debt and wanted to borrow dollars in order to trade, after all, they needed to buy their cars and petrol to drive around in at the very minimum. And what they did was they went to the World Bank and said, could I have a loan of a few million? And the World Bank said, absolutely, you can have. And then told them what they had to do. And they basically have organized the poorer countries of the world in such a way that they had to open their markets, they had to open their borders, and they had to have access to Western foreign capital from the great powers. And if you ask yourself why the parts of the world are so poor, still after so many years, you have to look at how the empire has organized itself. It has wanted the resources of the poor countries for its own. And perhaps the example above all other examples is the Congo. The Congo is a huge area of land, probably the size of Europe, with a tiny population, relatively speaking, with probably the greatest access to resources in the world. And it is the poorest country in the world in terms of its population. It has for over 100 years literally been raped. And it's been raped because it's had open access and open markets. And it has never been able to get away from the demands of the great powers for the copper and the cobalt and the gold and everything else which is part of the Congo. Now, the Congo is again the symbol that, if you keep in mind, which has also affected large parts of the Arab world. Their ability to enrich their own populations has been limited in many, many countries. And what the West ourselves offers is the possibility of the good life, of education, of health, and of a future wealth like we all have here. And that has been denied. Denied in too many places to too many people. And one of the explanations that you get for resistance and the growing resistance is to find alternative ways of organization. To find alternative politics which can support and provide new hope. And that is why China is so important. China has been big enough to and clever enough and smart enough not to get themselves involved in the World Bank and the IMF and to run their country in ways which are their own. Whether you call it capitalism or communism or a mixture of the two, however you do, they have been successful. So, what we have is a struggle by the different parts of the Islamic world to find a way to handle the modern imperial world of capitalism. And the struggle takes many different forms, but it's a real and profound struggle without any doubt. And if you look at it sympathetically, through those sorts of eyes, you can begin to have a different view to the one which is propagated everywhere. Now let me just deal with the ideology of empire, and then I'll close this this discussion. In my view, we are very close to being brainwashed. We are told that there are terrorists everywhere. If we get on an aeroplane, we have to take off our shoes to see if our if the soles are full of dynamite. And we are overwhelmed by surveillance. And in London, where I live, when I move out of my house, they can tell where I am at any time of the day or night. They can see me on cameras. They can see which public pieces of public transport I'm using. They can tell me where I am. Now, we know that we've been lied to, all of us, in a major way over the recent wars in Iraq. And those lies the government now almost takes for granted. And now that the Irish have voted in a referendum to allow the Lisbon Treaty in the EU will be centralised now, and we will have a new source of power, imperial power, to support the existing forms of imperial power. So we can see, we can look forward to the EU being even more a part of the efforts by the Americans. Now, there's a whole frame of reference which we need to look at and to understand. We talk about our own civilization as if this was something to be to be wondered at. And yet, the concept of civilization, which has been renewed in recent years since the end of the Cold War, is an old concept which was used by the colonists in order to justify their dominance over the people that we colonized. When I did my own doctorate many years ago now, what we talked about, what was talked about in everything I read, was that the civilized British would go into East Africa to colonize them for their own benefit. And the vast majority of people who went to do this believed it. And if I'd been a younger man, I might have been a district officer in the colonies. I would have only had to be 10 or 15 years younger, and I'm sure that I might have ended up as a colonial officer in goodness knows where. But my real point is this. We use the most extreme force wherever we need to. We justify it through words like civilization and terrorism. We have an ideology which allows us to persuade ourselves that we are a superior peoples. And the previous discussion, which we had a few minutes ago, is illustrative of just that ideology. We create our enemy. And I will give you another book that we have just published as an illustration. We produced a book a few months ago called The Dark Sahara. And it's a fascinating study of the Sahara and the creation of an Al-Qaeda cell. The Americans and the Algerians got together and they decided that they would take some tourists in Algeria, in the Sahara, where there are some wonderful things to see, by the way, if you are brave enough to be a tourist there. And they would capture them and tell everybody that this was an Al-Qaeda cell who was operating. And in order to make themselves clear that it was an Al-Qaeda cell, they did it 3 or 4 times over a period of 2 or 3 years. Again, you think, strange stuff. How on earth where does all this come from? But what was actually at stake was this. The Algerians wanted to cozy up to the Americans because they wanted modern weapons, and that they had been out on a limb for all sorts of local reasons. And the Americans wanted to produce new bases, because the amount of oil that is being found off the west coast of Africa is expanding daily. And it's the sort of oil that they want, nice, clean oil that they use in their motor cars. And so they wanted to produce a military presence throughout West Africa. And to do this, they justified it with these new Al-Qaeda cells. And my author, who has been working and living in the Sahara for a very long time and speaking all the local languages, was able to use his local knowledge and for the local people to tell him what was actually happening. And he wrote this up in the book for me. And this illustrates yet again the depth that our leaders will go to justify their empire and to pull the wool over our eyes and to avoid the realization that we are the terrorists and that people who resist us have an honorable rationale. Thank you very much.
What you have spoken about clarified on the remark you made earlier about racialism when we were discussing the cartoons and Rushdie and so forth and the response of the Islamic world. It seems to me that perhaps we don't get as exercised about attacks on Christ because we feel secure in being the empire. And from what the other speakers have said, it seems to me that the Islamic world feels oppressed, and any trigger like this does engender a much more serious reaction than it would if such an attack were made on us.
I mean, and there's no doubt what you're saying is correct. There was a time some years ago, and I've actually lost control of how long ago it was, when there were laws in England which limited what could be said in public about Christ. There was a case, I think, if I remember rightly, when Christ was portrayed as a homosexual on the cross in some shape or form. And this became a cause célèbre. Now, this was 10, 15, maybe even 20 years ago. I can't remember how long. And there was a court case about it. And it was lost. And saying that the person had a liberty to do that. And in some respects, when that happens, then the society at large has lost its sensitivities to these issues. But you're right as well that the Islamic world feels oppressed and feels much more sensitive than the Christian world when its icons are attacked.
Thank you for pointing this out, Roger. You know, what interests me is that precisely the lack of knowledge of this empire and the sheer monopoly of violence that is used continuously for 4 or 5 centuries now, you know, across all continents, that also gives rise to questions like, you know, cultural inferiority or immaturity of the other. You know, where nobody looks at the cultural supremacy of the self, you know, which doesn't have to look far on this particular continent or North and South America. I mean, the number of aboriginals killed runs into tens of millions. You know, what happened to the cultural inferiority or superiority at that time? You know, so this is the idea of empire is, like you said, has flowed from Britain to the U.S. and now across Europe. And, you know, it just needs to be examined. People in North America need to look at ourselves and say, hey, you know what? We're the problem. You know, those guys.
Yeah, I mean, I of course agree with that. And I think the sooner that we retreat from Iraq and Afghanistan, the better for everybody concerned. But that's not going to happen.
Exactly. I mean, you know, 1 million people have been killed in Iraq, okay, from the start of the American occupation. That is not part of the modern vocabulary in North America, whereas Bruce Lee, etc., are very much part of the vocabulary. You know, these few instances are constantly used to bang Muslims on the head saying, hey, you guys react. But hey, what happened to 1 million people killed in Iraq by, you know, sheer monopoly of violence?
Well, one can go further than that in Iraq. It's not, I mean, the number 1 million is so large that it's difficult to actually get your fingers on it. But what's happened It's not just the large number of people have been killed in internecine fighting. It's that death squads have been created. We think from the center, but certainly the intellectual community, the doctors, the university professors, the anybody in a professional capacity, has either been killed clearly and intentionally, or they have fled. And Iraq has been dismembered in a number of ways, but this way means that you cannot recreate a society without that middle class. And that middle class was there, and it is now gone, and probably gone forever.
Would you acknowledge any benefits to empire?
It's a nice question. I like it.
Just a point of...
No.
Healthcare and education in Africa.
Yeah, of course. It depends on so many things to answer that question. Are the people better off? Do they live longer? And so on. Certainly a lot more people stay alive. Who is better off? How do you measure it? You need to be, you need to have very clear criteria to pose that question and how you look at it. There's no doubt that more people stay alive, but are people richer or poorer than they were 100 years ago? Can you measure it? Very difficult. Very, very difficult to answer that question. Have they got railways? Maybe a few. I don't know how to answer it in the generality. You have to be specific on that one.
Okay, well, Zimbabwe then?
Zimbabwe, probably not.
Well,
I mean,
empire in reverse, does it look like Mugabe?
Well, Mugabe is obviously a horrendous dictator. He was always, Mugabe was always pro one part of the society and anti another part of the society. But what exactly happened to make it all go wrong? Was he wrong to throw out the white settlers? I personally think probably not. How he did it was probably very foolish, because he hadn't got anything else in its place, and he needed the finance that they created for the welfare of his society. So, difficult. Again, it's not a straightforward issue. None of these issues are straightforward, in my view.
So do you think the only reason, let's say, for example, Americans are mucking about in the Middle East is for empire building, or do you think it's about some neocons that have an ideology that they know the success in life, and they want to, for their own benefit, impose this way of life on other cultures, because they see it as the only proven method of happiness?
I find it difficult to think of any idealistic reasons that they're there for. I mean, you have to ask, when you ask that sort of question, you have to ask, why have they supported Israel under any circumstances, however morally indecent those circumstances are? I'm referring to Gaza here. What are they trying to do in the Middle East? My view is that it's a mixture of political control and oil. And if they don't get it, then there'll be the Russians and the Chinese will. So it's just like the struggle for Africa 130 or 40 years ago. If they're not there, one of their competitors will be there. They want to stay the top dog of the world, so they have to be there. And so the answer to your question is, they're not there for any idealistic purposes. They're not there to produce a better society in Iraq, because that's the ideological frame. They're not in Afghanistan to improve the lot of women. They're there for a complex of reasons, But it's always power is somewhere in the mix.
I just have a hard time with that because I would think there would be a lot easier ways to do it than.
Sorry?
There would be a lot easier ways to say to secure resources, for example, right? I mean, if that's your thesis, that's their biggest motivation. I would think there would be easier ways to secure resources in those countries than to start wars. Wouldn't it be easier just to prop up some friendly government there and get trade going that way?
Yeah. Well, of course. In many countries, they've done precisely that. I mean, in the Egyptians, the Saudis, and the Gulf, that's exactly what they've done. But when countries refuse to go the way that they want them to go, Iraq was a case in point. Iraq wanted to be independent of the overall power of the United States. And the Israelis felt that Iraq threatened them, rightly or wrongly, then the answer was invasion. And the neocons had wanted to invade long before 9/11.
Well, just on that point, at the same time, it's interesting that in America you couldn't sell the war, we're going to pour Iraqi oil or we want political control of the region, so you have to go for freedom and democracy. Right, so you have to use the ideological or the frame that we're fighting for an ideal cause. So our war is now a civilizing mission all of a sudden.
Yes, that is exactly correct.
And women's rights.
Women's rights.
Yeah,
right.
Of course.
I must admit, I was quite shocked to see that George Bush was going to become a poster boy for the women's. Well, maybe I shouldn't have been shocked, but I was.
But of course, all violence has to be. Made okay to its domestic population. If its domestic population disagrees in sufficient numbers and are willing to take to the streets enough, you have two choices. You either have to put your domestic population down by violence, or you lose your control of your overseas enterprise. And that's what nearly happened in Vietnam. They were losing control of the scene. So you have to create an ambience, an ideology, a framework which is acceptable to your majority of your population.
Do you see President Obama as making any particular kind of play on this? Do you see him urging?
I see Obama as a very dangerous man.
You really share that with the religious right. You know?
I know, I do. I often find myself with odd bedfellows, I have to say. But we have to see, of course, where Obama's going. But Obama has to do three things in some sort of order. He either has to create a healthcare system. He has to resolve the financial crisis of the United States and therefore of the world. And he has to resolve the problems in the Middle East. Now, if he fails on his domestic front, which is perfectly possible, but not absolutely certain yet, then he has to either do one of two things in his foreign policy. He has to solve his Middle East problem, or he has to become more violent to justify himself at all. Now, if he's going to sort out the Middle East, he has to deal with Israel. And the only way he's going to succeed in Israel is by using his monetary control. And it wasn't long ago when some billions were transferred into the Israeli exchequer just as he was trying to negotiate the control of the settlement movements. Now, if the Israelis play for time, as they have been very successful at playing for time from one president to another, and Obama is not willing to use his financial muscle, then he cannot resolve the problems of the Middle East at all. And so we need to look at the scenario with the religious right, perhaps, that he fails in his three major arenas, And what does he do then? Does he put his hands up and go home? Or does he go to war some more? And the possibility that all three will fail, look as a possibility at this particular point in history. We all hope that I'm wrong, but the situation in Pakistan and the growth of domestic warfare there is dire. So I'm frightened of where we're going for the moment. And if the economic downturn goes further and deeper, and if you read the business pages on a daily basis, whether I'm in Canada or America, there are half the population who says, we've only just started the economic crisis. So if we go into further depths of economic crisis, with further unemployment and inabilities to control the banking system, then then a government like any government in America would be looking to warfare as one way of resolving its own domestic issues.
It's really comforting to hear you.
You can imagine we're all going to sleep really well tomorrow.
I want to make sure I understood you properly. It seemed to me that you were laying the roots of poverty around the world at the feet of empire.
Yes.
And you used China as an example, which had escaped the tentacles of IMF and the World Bank. But my understanding is that China still, the vast majority of the Chinese still live in grinding poverty.
I'm sure you're right. I'm quite sure you're right. I can only say that China has moved a larger number of people in terms of numbers and proportion of its population out of the abysmal poverty, what the World Bank calls a dollar a day, than any other country on the globe. Whatever you think of the state in China, it's relatively uncorrupt. And that is a huge advantage to any nation state, but particularly a developing nation state. I was particularly impressed by Malaysia, which has an Islamic government and has oil. Now, oil is normally a terrible thing to happen to a country. Any country which has oil normally has the most appalling state of affairs.
You know what province you're in, don't you?
Yeah, I do. But
we actually are an oil
capital. I am talking about developing countries, I should have said.
So I haven't noticed that we were beyond that.
No, I would of course exclude Western countries from this type of analysis. But the Angolas, the Nigerias, the Saudis, and so on, all have the most appalling levels of poverty amid the most grotesque wealth at the center. When I was referring to Malaysia, when I went there with my good friend Ibrahim, I didn't know that they had oil. And the Islamic government had put all the oil revenues into a separate pocket so that they could be used for the benefit of the country. And you could see that. You could see that in the infrastructure of the country. And it was very impressive. But for most countries with oil, with the exclusion of Canada, of course, and the exclusion actually of all the developed countries, the major Western powers, the possibility of gross use of these resources is simply appalling. And it's it seems that God has put his wand on the people with oil countries and certainly not blessed them.
No, 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 no. one final
I was just wondering, I've been to, economics classes and lectures here on campus, and it seemed to be inevitable that we're at a change of empires, like on the verge of it. But often they would mention that China would be the next big one. So I'd like to know what your reasoning is for saying the EU will be the next.
No, I'm sorry if I said the EU would be the next. I didn't mean that. I don't think any major country ever gives up being the top major empire without a fight. One of the reasons I'm pessimistic at the moment is that the USA is deeply in debt. And if one way of losing your empire is to be in debt, hugely in debt, the UK was in debt from the 1418 war, and then the 39-45 war just put the kibosh on it. Debt was the killer. And as it is domestically, so it is nationally. So what is the consequence of that? My view is that the top imperial country will fight to stay the top country. There will be a struggle. I don't believe that they will, in the end, work together so that they share the power of the world among themselves. It would be unique if they did, and it would be wonderful for all of us if they did. And we have to hope that the new G20 actually works. But in the end, America wants its way. And in the last 10 years, when it has decided that the Geneva Conventions are not conventions that it needs to adhere to. They are out-of-date conventions. That we can move into a regime of torture without a blink of an eye and justify it. All these sorts of elements are the elements of an empire which has moved beyond its sell-by date. But what will happen next?
Thank you so much. Roger, really appreciate you.